You are listening to Talking Pictures. With the multifaceted film historian, lead film festival writer for Influx Magazine, multi-award-winning producer of feature films and shorts, your host, Mr. Paul Booth.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate all our listeners, supporters, most of all our guests who make this show possible. Always have to give a shout out and thanks to the audio team and production team and the people that make this show happen. It is not a one-man show, so thank you, thank you. It is the morning after the Oscars and we are celebrating Oscar month. And today we are going to be joined by Mr. William Sadler, known for so many great films over the years, independent, studio, television. He's got a big fan base. Today we're going to spend the good portion of the time discussing The Shawshank Redemption, which in 1994 was nominated for 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Actor for Morgan Freeman. It was the first nomination of the great cinematographer Roger Deakins. The movie walked away with none. And this is one of those rare examples where just a superb movie that at minimum should have had one walked away with nothing. Of course, it was the year of Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, so there was plenty of movies to split the vote and other films that were more palatable for audiences. Shawshank, brief history lesson, would find its audience on Laserdisc, DVD, and especially TV. One of those films that ranks with Goodfellas, which of course Frank Darabont cites Goodfellas as being his main inspiration, the narration part, that you cannot turn off if it's on TV. I'm not lying. I'm not saying this because it's The Guest. I watch this movie once or twice a month. And Mr. Sadler's calling through right now. Let me get him on the air.
Hello? Yes?
Hey, Mr. Sadler, how are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. On behalf of Talking Pictures
goodness.
And the production team and the listeners and guests and my friends that have been excited that you're going to be on, we thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes, yes.
Can I,
Oh, yes, yeah. Go ahead.
So you're in Hawaii.
Oh, no. Actually, I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles now. So,
confused.
So just doing it over the nice computer program now that we have, so I can record it anywhere. It's amazing.
The Aloha threw me off.
It's so weird. Yeah, I always use it. Everything I do, it follows me. You know that, from your ukulele experience.
Yes.
I was just mentioning, The Shawshank Redemption, and of course we're a night after the Oscars, and I was mentioning how we've had so few films that were, looking back in hindsight, no clue how the film was shunned of Oscars, and I was just discussing that it was the first of, I think it's now 12 nominations for Mr. Deakins, and I actually got to meet him the other day. It was so amazing meeting him. I mean, what a wonderful gentleman, as you know.
He's extraordinary, isn't he?
Oh, yes. It's just like, everybody was so trying to meet him. It was like, I said it felt like waiting at Disneyland to meet Mickey Mouse, and it was like, what I want to do is just do the usual that we run through your bio here, although I cannot count how many emails I've received of people talking about this film or that film that they love you for. But for those of you out there that don't know, I don't know what plant you've been on if you don't know Mr. Sadler's work, but we have, of course, The Shawshank Redemption, and we have The Green Mile, and we have Iron Man 3. We're celebrating this coming July 4th, the 25-year anniversary of Die Hard 2. We have, for people my age, the nostalgia of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, The Grim Reaper, which is, I'm sure, is a great credit when you say Shawshank Redemption, Bill and Ted's. But we got to love the Bill and Ted's. I saw on IMDb you had done some episodes of Hawaii Five-O, which is awesome. Recently, of course, The Historian, and then Deadly Crush, and we can get to all that. And I also want to let you know today we'll talk about anything that you have coming up that you want to mention. But,
sure.
Of course, with it being Oscars, The Shawshank Redemption, what I would love to say is, what would be the first thing that would come to your mind about The Shawshank Redemption? If you're just meeting someone who's never heard of it and you had to tell them, what would be your assessment?
I think it's funny. I was as the Oscars were approaching this year, I was thinking about Shawshank quite a bit, I've spoken to Frank about this as well, Frank Darabont, the writer-director, and we sort of agree that we caught lightning in a bottle, was his phrase, that you couldn't plan all the happy accidents, that all of the stars and the moon had to align for the movie to be what it became. And also, nobody knew when we were shooting it that 20 years down the road, more people would enjoy it now than did when it first opened. I think it made like $18 million in the theaters. It was like a flop. It was literally a flop. It opened, did nothing, and closed. And then it was nominated some months later for, what was it, five or six or, I think.
Yeah, there's seven, and there's that wonderful prison
including
that was
Best
built.
Picture.
Yes, but of course, the Best Picture and the Best Director.
At which point, they re-released it in the movie theaters, and it began to get, people began to look at it again. But it was so overlooked when it first came out. I think part of that was the title. The name Shawshank. I remember seeing Frank with lists of alternate titles. The original title of the story that it was based on is Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah,
that's the
Stephen King
that was
short
the shooting
story.
Title of our shooting title as well. But the title, Shawshank Redemption, means nothing. You know, it's a made-up sort of Indian name. Redemption sounds vaguely religious. It's a three-hour, a long prison movie. It had a lot of stuff working against it if you didn't know anything at all about the film. But I think what's remarkable to me about it is that story of hope and friendship between men, conquering everything, you know, coming out winning in the end so beautifully, it just resonates. We needed to hear that story, you know. We needed to hear little guys who get shit on, who've gotten a raw deal. You can win. You can, you know, if you're patient and you're smart, you know, the hand of fate will come around and, you know, you'll find your beach in Zihuatanejo.
That's I love that you say the beach, because that film, ultimately, to me, I think it was Frank Darabont, or it might have been on that Charlie Rose on that great two disc. Everyone out there, if you haven't seen it, you have to find this movie and see it. I don't know anyone that hasn't seen it. But talking about one of the first movies to deal with friendship that's not about chasing the girl or partying, and I always think of the movie as kind of like, as it's grown on me, and I've watched it. I'll sometimes watch it once every 6 weeks. I always kind of think of it, it really is like a love story between two men, and it doesn't have to stir up the, yeah, it's not the controversy like Brokeback Mountain was, but it's like when Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman hug, I'll admit to this day I cry because I think of friends of thinking like, what if I thought I was never going to see them again? And then to see them coming up the beach, that would be my first thought, would be to burst into tears. And that moment just so perfect, and the score, and the helicopter shot, and the, I mean, just so amazing.
As I recall, Frank added that moment too. There is in the book, there is no meeting on the beach. Frank decided that he wanted to see that. He wanted to see. He had to see Red walking down the beach in a, you know, in his little suit, and finding his friend at long last. It was just I'm not exactly sure what it is about that film but it strikes a chord in people that I don't know of another film that's done that quite the same way.
Well,
and
yeah,
it's funny too. There is homosexual sex in it. There is gay sex. I mean, it's rape, but it's there. I mean, there's a dark side to that place. But what triumphs is this love between the two men. You know, the hope that Andy and the hope, you know, freedom.
What I really enjoyed about your performance in the film is that, and I'm sure it was intentional, or I would love to know if there was something that wasn't, where there seems to be, I was just thinking about this the other day, and I don't know why I didn't notice it before, where there seems to be these great comic relief moments that Haywood provides, and they seem, and I know it's the editing, and I know it's the great writing of Frank Darabont, to have these very serious moments, like you're saying, where there's rape and there's the wrongfully accused guy and there's the message of losing hope. There's murder, and then you have these great hilarious moments. I mean, when you guys are looking for rocks, I mean, that'll be funny 100 years from now. I mean, that's just
I decided sort of early on when we were, as we were beginning to rehearse the movie. It's also the very first movie, and one of the only movies that where they brought the actors together and rehearsed us. We actually rehearsed like a play for a couple of weeks in the prison, in this abandoned prison in Mansfield, Ohio. So we got to know each other, and the reason for that was because it spans 19 years, and Frank wanted us to develop these little relationships that looked like we've been together in this place forever, you know. But I decided sort of early on that Haywood was not the brightest bulb in the sign. And as a result, he's always... I mean, that was like the confusion about finding rocks, and he finds a horse ball, and the horse turns, doesn't know it, or he doesn't know how to pronounce Alexander Dumas, you know, dumbass. Some of it was in the script, and some of it I just took it and ran with a little bit. But by making Haywood's IQ, you know, something really low, he was always a step behind every conversation that he was in. He was always catching up with Red or catching up with Andy. How was I supposed to know about giving him the rope or...
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? He's like, he just... And I just found that a very human. It made him human. It made him not a threatening cardboard sort of bad guy, which to some degree was what was on the page. That, you know, he makes that bet and wins the bet that gets fat ass killed.
Right.
And then he's gloating about it, and he won all these cigarettes, and it's like, and Andy says, "What happened to him? He died." You know, he says, you know, what? I believe I owe that boy a big sloppy kiss, and finds out that he's dead, that he was killed by the guards in that, you know, he's clubbed to death. And then there was, you know, and his reaction to Andy, when Andy says, what was his name? That's sort of who Haywood was on the page, was, you know, what do you care, fresh fish? He's dead, you know?
Right, it's he's just dead, that kind of move, you know, forward mentality,
F
right?
F you. Don't, you know, who the hell are you asking me that question, you know? You and defensive and angry and, you know.
Well, you had a great moment.
I wanted him to be more than that. I just wanted him to be more than that. I wanted him to be funny.
Because you had a great moment of subtlety when the guy, the character Fat Ass, I'm not being derogatory towards heavyset people, but that's the name in the movie for the, you know,
right,
for those
right,
who didn't see it. When he's, you know, the way you put this bed and you have this writing on this and you're gloating, but there's this one key moment where while he's being beaten, then all of a sudden it's like there's just this look you make of like it's right back to, oh wait, this is, you know, it's like I'm gonna gain cigarettes from someone dying. Like this isn't fun. This isn't just school, the guys in the yard.
The guys are coming, the guards are coming in to see what all the ruckus is, and Fat Ass, the character Fat Ass, is still howling and crying, and I added that little moment of shut up, just shut up. It's just this very quick little split second thing of like, they're gonna beat the crap out of you. Shut up, and it's too late, and it doesn't work. And I got him killed, you know. Or we got him killed. That wasn't what we set out to do. I just wanted to win some cigarettes, you know. It's funny. It's like the and to Frank's credit, he saw these little touches and these little moments that I kept adding and thinking up. The way that Haywood would be like one step behind. Red says at one moment, he says, I think we ought to gather up some rock. I think we should surprise him when he comes back. Let's go get some rocks. And Haywood is standing there. And he nods like, yeah, let's surprise. And then and it's like just this split second when it's like, rocks? What are you talking about? Frank was great. And it's funny because it's another example of like he's just one step behind every conversation that he's in. He doesn't understand.
Well, that speaks to the really great performance on your part and direction. Because for anyone who doesn't know, or even if you've just gotten to hear Mr. Sadler in an interview, he is so, and I don't say anything to, you love that saying in L.A., blow smoke. I mean it completely sincerely when it's your intelligence and your intelligence in the characters you play and what you bring to it speaks more even to the volume of how well Haywood was played, has the kind of step behind and has the kind of, I remember when we spoke over the summertime in that other interview where I asked you, I didn't know if you really had a stutter. And that was kind of like, that was such a brilliant nuance.
Stutter.
Yeah.
I added the stutter for the same reason, because it took the edge off of this bad man. It's hard to be afraid of someone who stutters. It makes him just a little bit more vulnerable.
You have the best line in the movie. Innocent lawyer fucked me. It gets me every time. I don't care how many times I watch that movie. I could watch it every day this week, and I laugh every time. And when Morgan Freeman says, "You're going to fit it. Right in."
Didn't do it. More affect me.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's now.
So,
good.
Let me ask you this. You watched the Oscars last night. What did you
think? Yes.
What did you think of the nominees and the winners?
You know, there was only a few nominees that I missed because they were either in and out, like Mr. Turner and Ida, so I didn't get to see all the cinematography, but I saw Birdman, and I saw Imitation Game, I saw Unbroken. I really liked Boyhood. I liked not only that we know what goes behind the business of getting agents and managers and everyone to agree to not change price and not cancel and let something last 12 years, and not because you're over budget and not because you're over schedule and not because you're in development hell, but because the story dictates that the actors have to wait. I enjoyed Birdman. I mean, I think anybody who has any part of the business could appreciate the cinematography. Something that I'm glad that you brought up would be, you know, with the Oscars is that I realize where that's like, it's almost like there should be a Steadicam Operator Academy Award. But overall, I was happy with most things.
I thought that too. I was blown away by the cinematography for Birdman. I was just, it was kind of breathtaking and brave, really brave if you think about it. The scene, there would be scene after scene after scene where the camera would follow Michael Keaton into a room where Ed Norton is, you know, or someone else, you know, there's another character there. And the camera would, the camera never blinked. There was no editing. If you watch it again, try to count the number of times that the editor got in there with scissors. And when ordinarily you shoot a scene like that, there's sort of a master. You get a general idea of where people are in the room, and then you start punching in closer and closer on the different faces as they have important words or reactions or whatever. And that's how most stories get told on film. In Birdman, they came in, sat the camera down, and did the scene the way you would in the theater. The camera would move, but the camera never blinked, which was absolutely amazing. It was like you couldn't look away because the camera never looked away.
And there were all those great transitions, transition editing, right? It's like it made me think of The West Wing as a two-hour movie, the way that was so. I remember when people flipped out of
the hallway.
You catch that.
It would go
frame
down the hallway, and
the door.
I kept trying to figure out, you know, where are they cutting? Where is the cut? Where's the cut? Which I guess pulled me out of the. I'm aware of how things get shot. I did a movie called The Hotspot. Dennis Hopper directed it, and he tried again and again with that film to do these sort of long, long, involved one take shots where the whole scene happens in one long take. And Don Johnson was the star, and Don had a real problem. He fucking hated that because he had just come off Miami Vice master medium, close up, we're out of here. It's just, you know, cut it, get the scissors in there. Because you can save a scene. If you can get scissors in there, you can get the dead air out, you can remove a bad line, you can fix things, you know. The editor can save you. If you're not gonna cut anywhere, it's gotta play in one big long take, then everything about the way you play it has to be perfect.
Right. Well, and you're, as an actor,
and that's really hard. That's really, really hard to do. You know, it's like in a funny way, it's like listening to old jazz recordings. You know, if you listen to Louis Armstrong or the recordings of orchestras or big jazz bands from back then. They sat in a room with a couple of microphones, and they played the song all the way through, all of them together. And everybody had their solo. They stepped up and they did their solo. And then what you hear in the recording is one take. They didn't, you know, the trumpeter didn't go back and fix anything. They didn't have the technology. The whole thing happened in one beautiful living take. And everybody got it right. You know, or not, but
well, and plus you're
but
well, and plus as
but
an actor,
like a tightrope,
right,
know,
right, as an and
as
an actor for
Birdman
with the, and speaking of Oscars, I mean, that must have been a completely different eye that you had, because what I was thinking, just as filmmaking experience, was thinking of, okay, with this 6 minute shot, it could be at 5 minutes and 55 seconds if that actor falls out of their chair. That whole six-minute shot is gone. So, as an actor, is it how could you prepare ahead of to be like, okay, Michael Keaton better be on, and Edward Norton better be on, and that guy who's supposed to walk by better not slip.
Talk about it. I have a feeling they rehearsed it like a play. I have a feeling they rehearsed those scenes the way you would a play. You know, rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed until you can burn right through this stuff. You know. No question, no hesitation. You can just fly. You can just fly at it. I don't know.
Were you happy with
pull it off? I wanted Keaton to win for Best Actor. I just thought that was quite an accomplishment, and I've admired his work for a long time, and I'm
a big fan of his.
There was a part of me that went. That thought, Eddie Redmayne did a wonderful job as Stephen Hawking. I mean, he really did. He did that beautifully. He also looked exactly like Stephen Hawking, and he had the advantage of having this disease, which is something to play. You end up playing the disease a lot as well, you know.
I don't know.
You get me talking about British actors and diseases. I thought McConaughey won for AIDS last year, and this year it was Stephen Hawking and Julianne Moore for Alzheimer's, and it's like.
Oh right, I mean that we do have those Academy.
It's funny, like. Really, is this like becoming the disease of the month? Is the disease of the year?
Right. I always say the Academy likes, and again, it's not. excuse me. I've always noticed the Academy likes diseases, and the Academy likes. There's no. I forget. I do not know the PC way now to say, not mentally retarded, but Rain Man or My Left Foot, and Rain Man is a great performance.
Or Gump.
Gump. I mean, and please, Gump. I mean, and I'm so glad because that ties in right in there to Shawshank. I cannot tell you how many arguments I've had with people that Gump just does not touch Red by any shape. I mean, it's not even a bias to Shawshank. It's not even because we were talking about it.
I liked Forrest Gump as well. I just thought I didn't. That was. And it's funny, too. I don't know that Gump has survived quite as well as...
Oh, no. It's. I think it's more of a nostalgia. I mean, and speaking, you know, like, for me, I was really pulling for, even though I knew Birdman was going to win, I actually covered the ASC Awards last week, and I know those are usually the on par, but I really wanted to see Deakins win because I just thought, like, as much as this is not about awards and to hit your guys' level, it can't be. But it's just like, what does Roger Deakins have to do to be, you know, like, you know, like, I mean, it's
has he never won?
I do not want to be incorrect, but I'm I'm just going to look this up real quick, if it was his 11th or 12th nomination. And he's never won. And Shawshank was
the
first.
Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah, he'll be the Lifetime Achievement Award, which really, I don't believe that should be.
Paul Newman or something, you know, nominated 100 times and never won.
Yeah, 12th, it was his, it was Deakin's 12th, and it started with Shawshank. And now if we look at Shawshank in 94 till the year we're at now, we are looking at that Roger Deakins gets nominated every other year.
Jeez.
I mean, we're talking here No Country for Old Men, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I don't understand.
Like some of my favorite movies of all time. Actors get a lot of credit for how wonderful the movies end up being. I have to tell you, cinematography is when it's brilliant, the way Deakins does it, you don't notice it. You just get carried, you get swept along with the story. You're not supposed to sit there and think, what a great shot that was, you know. Did you see the way the flag came in at the end and blah, you know. You're not supposed to drop out of the story to notice how wonderful the cinematography is. So it's a very, and I think most people don't. When it's done really, really well, you get sucked into the story. You just get swept away by the story, by what you're seeing on that screen, and that's all cinematography. That's, you know.
Well, I remember a guy in film school.
Actors are a part of it, sure, but. But I give tremendous credit to the people who make the pictures, you know.
Oh, well, I mean the cinematographer.
Keep the camera moving.
Yeah, Deakins talks
because that's
frequently.
That's really deciding how you're going to tell the story. It's not what the story is, but it's.
Oh, I'm sorry. We had a technical difficulty there where we. We lost Mr. Sadler. I'm going to keep talking here. He's going to call back in. We apologize for that. So what he was talking about was the cinematographer. Those of you that don't know, the cinematographer is the one who lights and who sets up the camera and oversees the crew that does that and works with the director to choose each shot. And it really is, as Mr. Sadler said, is what makes the decision of how you're going to tell the story, because it's giving you all your shots for the editors. It's giving you all your camera placement for the actors to do their thing. It's there's so much that goes into it, and Roger Deakins is just the master. I mean, for those of you that don't know, he's shot, like I'd said, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?, No Country for Old Men, Fargo. He's made 11 films with the Coen brothers. He is just an amazing... Are you back with us, Mr. Sadler?
I am. I just called.
Oh, okay.
Again.
Yeah, I was just saying how Roger Deakins and all of his work and how he frequently mentions Conrad Hall. And I remember and of course, so you guys know now, there's also a Conrad Hall Jr., I remember in film school, it was right after American Beauty, and they will remain nameless because I have film school buddies that listen to this. Someone had kind of alluded to that American Beauty, and you will really like this comment, that American Beauty was like the emergence of Conrad Hall. And I think to know that he had won for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and, of course, would win for Road to Perdition the next year with Sam Mendes. But Roger Deakins said something great in a Hollywood Reporter roundtable where he said, sometimes I get to set and I still don't know what I'm doing. And I learned that from Conrad Hall. So my question for you is the way you guys caught lightning in a bottle and still said there kind of was, you didn't know Shawshank would be what it was. Was there as an actor where you could be around Deakins and so you can kind of sit back now and be like, Yeah, that I could kind of see where Roger was going to be, you know, the Conrad Hall of this era or the James Wong Howe of this era. You know, like, was it the way you can just sense it about artists?
I think I'm trying to remember the experience of filming with Deakin was he creates this. First of all, he was there at these rehearsals that we had before we started filming, so he knew beforehand what we were all going to do in the scenes. He had a pretty good idea. And he and Frank would discuss the shots. You know, this is going to be a tracking shot, and this is going to be a, you know, I'm going to be up on the roof and follow him over to the edge and blah, blah. Shawshank was still pretty early in my career, and I think I was focusing more on the performance and my fellow actors and... Well, for example, we're sitting around the table with James Whitmore and Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins and so on. I wasn't thinking about where is the camera right now or what's Roger doing with the camera. Everybody brought their A game, and everybody, it's sort of like a tennis match, you know, and you sit down with McEnroe, you know, you're going to bat this ball around the table. But what was really fun was that everybody sort of brought their A game. Everybody leaned forward. So it didn't matter where, in a way, it didn't matter where you aimed the camera. There was a face that was alive, that was catching this conversation and had a reaction to it. The story was being told in every face all the way around that table, which was unusual. You know, I don't think I've seen that since Shawshank.
Well,
ensemble thing.
And so, you know, Shawshank Redemption was, you know, looking at your credits was, you know, obviously just one of the, you know, the enduring classics and the. And I always have this kind of thing where sometimes I say, you know, even girls like that movie, and I find it funny because I just know tons of girls who love that movie, and then I always tell people it's not a prison movie, it's about friendship. But
yeah,
I know in our in our printed interview we had talked about Die Hard 2, but I just wanted to, because it is the 25-year, and I know you had given us a great answer in Flux Magazine, but and again, if you don't want to talk it, that's totally fine. We can move on to another film. But I would love for this audience to hear the way you so eloquently put when we talked about how, of course, you're from New York, and in Die Hard 2, you played a terrorist that, you know, took over an airport, and that is obviously a film that would not get made today. That would not happen. So as we celebrate the 25-year anniversary, we don't glorify 9/11. We certainly don't forget. But that is one of the great things about films, is that it can capture a time of something that could have went on then. That was, when I looked it up, July 4th release date. So that was supposed to be our eat your hot dogs and go entertain your family. And now no one would go see it. So, is there something that you could say about, you know, how you had told me about ever being offered something like that again as an American or even a New Yorker?
I find it interesting that I think occasionally the movies imagine things that then become reality. It's like we put it out, we put it into the air. We put it into the community, the conversation, and the idea of crashing planes full of people to teach someone a lesson. I don't think it had ever been done before, and I hate to think that that's where they got the idea from. But the idea came from somewhere, you know. I worry about that. There's another film that I forget the name of it, this Under Siege, I think, with Denzel Washington about terrorism in New York City.
Oh, yes, there is. Yes, yes, yes.
Is it Under Siege, I think?
Yes, yeah, Under Siege, yeah.
Holy crap, that's like, I caught a bit of it the other, I don't know, a month or so ago, and I was just shocked, because that's another movie from back in the 90s when none of this had happened yet. And there it was, big as life, you know, what would happen, you know.
Well, I also saw on IMDb that you got to be...
I guess I don't really have a, you know, you don't want to think that you've put something out there that wasn't there before, and now, you know, people are going to, some crazy person is going to think, ooh, that, boy, I hadn't thought of that, you know.
Oh, right,
I'll give you an example. I did a movie called Kinsey, right, with Liam Neeson played Dr. Kinsey, the sex researcher. And he interviews a man that I played. It's sort of like the movie's going along, and the lesson that we're learning is that all of these variations are fine. There are variations in people's sexuality that are all okay, you know? We all have a little of this and a little of that. Until he interviews my character, whose name is Kevin Brunn, and he was a real person. He was an actual guy who worked for the Forest Service in real life, and he had kept track of all the different kinds of sex that he'd ever had, with different species, with different, you know, every conceivable variation you can imagine. And he had kept copious records of how it went with all of these things. He's a real twisted puppy.
Right.
and it's a turning point in the movie, because we realize that Kinsey realizes that, you know, there's a real dangerous dark line that you can cross, and Brunn crossed it. You know, it's not okay. Some of these variations are okay. A lot of what he did is not okay. And Bill Condon, when we did, my character had this little speech, this little monologue where he says, "I've slept with 23 different species of animals, and 240 pre-adolescent boys and 161 pre-adolescent girls." And he's like, all of this really shocking, alarming, disgusting stuff. And there were some other variations that were in the speech when I first read the script that Condon cut, because he didn't want to put it out there. That this
right.
was it. he didn't want to put it up on a motion picture screen and then hear years later that somebody saw it and thought, "Oh fuck, I hadn't thought of that." You know?
Right. No, there is I believe in
he
that.
Felt He felt
I believe in that putting. I believe in that. What you're saying of that's why a lot. So many artists that I know say, even sometimes just telling your friend an artistic idea mm-hmm. puts it out in the universe for someone else to find. And so that's really
yeah.
interesting what you're saying, because that is so. And to have that reflection of that you put out that you were a terrorist, and I know I think I remember telling you when we had done that interview, that was the first time I was ever scared by a movie character, because I don't like to fly, and I remember thinking, I for so many years, I associated your face with, oh my gosh, someone could actually do that, until I saw Shawshank and then thought, oh, okay, this is, because I was so young, I was only like 11, so I didn't get acting, and that's really just a guy that goes away. I, you know, that wonderful world where we think movies are real, right? So it's like, but you got to be, you got to be part of the Pathway to 9/11 series. Is there something that you would like to say about that?
That was a, that was an interesting. That was Harvey Keitel, who was a who's a wonderful actor. He was great to work with, and it was fun to to look at the other side of 9/11, to look at the to examine the something that is sort of seared in the American consciousness. I mean, we were all horrified to watch the towers go down, and then learning what led up to it, learning, you know, about the various people who said it's coming, you know, and tried to stop it, which is what Harvey Keitel, what his character did, was it was fascinating.
Well, that's is there a movie that for you, outside of Shawshank? I mean, we have Green Mile, which of course I know it was the smaller part of the gentleman with the daughters who were killed, or Iron Man 3, or I know you did some episodes of Hawaii 5-0. Before we get into where we use our last. 5 or 8 minutes to give a guest a chance to talk about what they're up to or what they'd like people to know about that's new. Is there a film that you have for you that's kind of like if you were setting up your own film festival retrospective of you and they weren't picking the films for you, that you would say, you know, this is what I'm proud of, or this is what I learned, or this is something that reflects me?
I guess the one that we haven't talked about yet is that I'm pretty proud of is, and it's silly because it's a silly comedy, is Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Oh,
right, the Grim Reaper.
Yes, yes.
The Grim Reaper in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. I'm pretty proud of that guy. He was, that was really fun. And it was great to. I'm glad you thought what I did in Shawshank was humor, or like bringing out the humor in that guy, or being the comic relief in that film. In Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, it's a comedy. That was my job, to be the scary death guy who gets everything wrong and can't win the games and can't do anything right around these two idiots, and then becomes part of the band. And I wrote the Reaper rap.
I was gonna say the Reaper. I always think of the Reaper rap.
I ended up improvising a lot of that stuff. There was a scene where they're all in a hardware store, and the Reaper is there's a guy smoking a cigarette, and as the Grim Reaper walks by, he leans over and says, "See you real soon." And the guy puts his cigarette out. I came up with that idea while we were shooting the hardware store. That scene's not in the script. But I told Peter Hewitt, the director, and he said he didn't have an actor to play the smoking guy, so he did it. That's the director. That's Peter Hewitt.
Oh, okay.
But it was sort of like that kind of thing. If you just kept coming up with funny ideas, and Hewitt was great about it. He was. You know, it really felt like a creative collaboration. It wasn't just, these are your words, say the words and get, you know, you do your job and I'll do my job. part of my job was to be funny and create this person, this crazy Czechoslovakian sounding death person. And once I tapped into my, once I gave myself license to be really silly in that character, I couldn't turn it off. The character just kind of took over, and all of that stuff about, you know, what about my butt? Reaping burns a lot of calories, and that's, it was all improvised. The Reaper rap was, I wrote the Reaper rap. You might be a king or a little street sweeper, but sooner or later you dance with the Reaper.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so, I'm waiting for it to pop up on Netflix, because Excellent Adventure has been up for so long, and I'm right that age where that was just like the thing that hit, and then Bogus Journey hit when I was like 12 or 13, and and of course it was that great Kiss song that came from it, and but that's really interesting, Bogus Journey, because I really think of if the festival was saying, you know, 12 o'clock Die Hard 2 and 2 o'clock Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, just that's a really cool answer, because what would people say, you know, would they walk from Bogus Journey into Shawshank?
I wonder sometimes if, because I did it, because I you know, the jobs, I came along and I auditioned for them and I got them. I wonder sometimes if I hadn't done Bogus Journey, if I would have then played more evildoers, you know, because Hollywood loves to do that, you know, they love to sort of pigeonhole you and say, oh no, he's great at that thing he does really well, and they're very uncomfortable letting you try something that's out of that box. But then once you do something as silly as Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, I wonder if they're then reluctant to bring you back as, you know what I'm saying. It's like...
Oh, yes. No, you, oh, no, completely. Not, I mean, that's...
It's like...
I think that's one of the... It's so great that you mentioned
done, it. It's sort of, do you lose your street cred as a bad guy or something, you know?
Right, yeah, no, it's so, I remember one time I interviewed Paul Sorvino, and he was telling me about Goodfellas, and he said, you know, it probably took 2 or 3 years before people, like, that knew me or that met me didn't treat me like I was going to, like, break their legs, or, you know, I'd have friends that, like, you know, maybe they owed me a few bucks, and I'm going to pay him, and he'd be like, that was a movie. Like, I'm not really going to, like, put you in a truck and haul you. Like, and he just said he found it so funny because it was like, it was great. I got, you know, it was a good experience. I'm so far from Pauly. I mean, that's why we're actors. Like, I don't run a mob. So, as we head into our last 5 minutes here, is there any films you have coming up that you've worked on? I mean, I'd seen, I don't know if you want to talk about Deadly Crush or just anything that's kind of open floor to you.
There's one that I think that I did with Woody Harrelson called By Way of Helena. And I'm not sure that was the title we shot it under, By Way of Helena. And it's set in like the 1880s in Texas. It feels a little bit like Apocalypse Now, set in Texas right after the Civil War.
Interesting.
And I play the governor of the state of Texas who sends, I send people off to get Woody Harrelson, who's this renegade Texas Ranger turned crazy man who runs this. He's a preacher. He's an evangelist, and he's just, and it's Woody being just as crazy as possible.
That's already wrapped. Is that
soon? Yeah, we shot that. October, November, something like that.
Okay.
So there's that. And there's... In May, I think, I go to Halifax and shoot another Jesse Stone movie with Tom Selleck.
Oh, yes, and I know. Fun. What is there? I think there's like five or six of those. My dad is a huge fan of those, and so when I was looking at your IMDb page, yeah, he loves all those.
I was flipping around one night on TV, and I saw, I think, the first one that Tom Selleck did of that series, the Jesse Stone series. And I was absolutely riveted, because it was the first time I'd ever seen Selleck play somebody as dark and damaged as that. And he played it beautifully. He played it great. He was, you know, he broke the rules. It was just this great character in a dark place that I had never seen him go. And I remember commenting to myself that's great. That's really lovely. And then a month or two later, they called me and asked me if I wanted to play this, he's a gangster, but he's a gay gangster named Gino Fish, who is a friend of Jesse's and helps him solve crimes and what have you. They work on opposite sides of, you know, they're on different teams. But there's this wonderful sort of respectful admiration they have for each other that's been great fun to play ever since I said yes to Gino Fish. He's funny. He's very, very smart. He loves Jesse, but Jesse's can be a pain in the ass. Jesse is a law enforcement. You know, Jesse is the sheriff of this little tiny town in Maine. And Gino is a gangster. Gino works for the other team. And it's just been great, great fun to play. So I'm looking forward to that. I get to go back and do another one of those.
Well, that's fantastic, and we love Woody, yeah. So we'll keep that out. And
yeah, I know. He's great. I'll tell you a funny Woody Harrelson. Woody and I met when I was doing. This is how far back we go. I think it was 83. Something like that, 1983, I was doing Biloxi Blues on Broadway, and Woody Harrelson was the understudy for a couple of the guys in the show. Woody used to show up at the theater like understudies do. They would show up at half hour and stick their head in the door and say, and they have to wait around until the curtain goes up, and then they can go away, right? Make sure everybody's there and everybody's going to go on. Everybody's healthy. Everybody's going on. And then, Woody was kind of a crazy man even back then. That was before Cheers and before anything. But I remember we laughed about that.
Well, that's
interesting guy. Talented man.
Guy. He's just such a just the chameleons and all these great actors.
Seriously.
Yourself and that you've gotten to work with, and we thank you so much for stopping by our show today, and we will make sure to get this link off to you, and we will mention these films when they come up, and we'll
very
stay
cool.
on radar and make sure that we support the future work, but we just want to, make sure again that we know our production team and our audio guy and all of us. We were just very thankful to have you here today, and it was very great to talk movies with you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent.
Take
and
care.
You have a wonderful day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Aloha. Well, we thank Mr. William Sadler for coming on our show today. That was a fantastic experience. again, we're all fans of his. We all love his movies. And we want to thank most of all, as always, you, the listener, for tuning in. This has been Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. Have a great day and make sure and watch some good movies. Aloha.
The name Talking Pictures was created by Alexa Foreman. Web design by Josh Lang. Written by Paul Booth and Rob Sterrett. Produced by Rob Sterrett and Jim McNulty. Executive producers Carolyn Booth and Paul Booth. Audio production by Dustin Lucas.